Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Ezekiel chapter 20. We'll do the first 31 verses of chapter 20 today. I will call this audio Israel's Continuing Rebellion. We start with verse 1. In the seventh year, in the fifth month, on the tenth day, some of the elders of Israel came to inquire of the Lord, and they sat down in front of me. That sat down in front of Ezekiel, who is, of course, living in exile by the river Chebar. Now, this prophecy is in the seventh year. In chapters 8 through 19, the prophecy was in the sixth year. So we're 1 year later than those previous 12 chapters. Now, how do we compute the year? Well, it's the seventh year of what? Of Ezekiel's exile. In 597, when Jehoiachin, the king of Israel, was carted off into captivity to Babylon, Ezekiel went in the train of those exiles, and so that's the year he's starting from. 597 minus Ezekiel went with him. And so 597 minus 7 gives you 590. We'll broaden the date a little bit to take care of the fractions of a year, so it's somewhere between 591 and 589. Remember, the Babylonian siege was begun in 588, the siege of Jerusalem, and it was concluded in 586 when Jerusalem was burnt down. Now, Calvin has a comment here about the mention of the date here. Calvin says this: "This computation was calculated to make them cherish the more ardently the hope of the restoration promised to them in 70 years. That's referring to Jeremiah's famous 70 years. Jeremiah said that the Babylonians were going to be in the ascendancy for 70 years. If you calculate that between 609 and 539, that's 70 years, 539 being the year of the decree, or the year of the defeat of Babylon by Persia, I should say. At any rate, and I realize the 70 years computation is disputed, controverted, but I think that's the easiest way to explain it. And the Jewish elders would have had that prophecy by Jeremiah, and so they're thinking, hot dog, it won't be long, we're going to go home. 70 years is a long time, but it's a lot shorter than forever. Calvin says, when prospects are hopeless, years are not computed. It's an interesting comment, but at any rate, for whatever reason that Ezekiel tells us, this is what we're talking about, and again, it's good to know the context. It's right before the siege of Babylon. Now, the elders came, probably to Ezekiel's house. It doesn't say, but I assume that's so. The elders sat down in front of Ezekiel in verse 1. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown gives three options as to why they sat. He doesn't take a strong position on why. He leaves it to us to decide, but here's option number one. Big shots don't stand before their inferiors. And these were the elders of Israel. They considered themselves big shots, and so they sat down in front of Ezekiel. Option number two, they sat down because they were showing that they were going to stay a long time. And they can't stand a long time, but they can sit a long time. And by golly, they're going to stay there until they got an answer from Ezekiel. Option number three, they were just being polite, sitting in somebody's house was just the common custom of Israel to sit before the host. Well, I don't know why they were sitting, but they were sitting, and we go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 2 through 7. Then the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Have you come to inquire of me? As surely as I live, I will not let you inquire of me, declares the sovereign Lord. And then God turns to Ezekiel, and he says, will you judge them? Will you judge them, son of man? Then confront them with the detestable practices of their fathers and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. On the day I chose Israel, I swore with uplifted hand to the descendants of the house of Jacob and revealed myself to them in Egypt. With uplifted hand, I said to them, I am the Lord your God. On that day, I swore to them that I would bring them out of Egypt into a land I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most beautiful of all lands. And I said to them, each of you get rid of the vile images you have set your eyes on, and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now in verse 3, God says to Ezekiel, son of man, this is the common address that God addressed Ezekiel with. Two theories as to why son of man could mean you, Ezekiel, have the characteristics of a man. And men are fallible. They put on their pants one leg at a time. And so just because you're a prophet, don't think you should get to be too proud. I don't like that option. I like option number two. God is deliberately using a messianic term to make Ezekiel a type of Jesus, because Jesus called himself the Son of Man all the time. How is Ezekiel a type? Well, he prophesied to a rebellious house of Israel, and the main thing he was prophesying about was the burning of the temple by the Babylonians in 586, whereas the antitype, Jesus, was also speaking to a rebellious house, and he prophesied about the destruction of the temple in AD 70, the Olivet Discourse, not one stone will be left on top of another. And of course, the phrase Son of Man comes from Daniel 7:14, when the Son of Man went up to the Ancient of Days, and the Son of Man there would be Jesus. Son of Man, verse 3, speak to the elders of Israel. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. Sovereign, he's in control of history. He's in control of when the historical actors are going to let the Jews go back to Jerusalem. The Lord says, have you come to inquire of me? Now, that's a rhetorical question. Or it could be a rhetorical question. As in, really? You people are as sinful as you can be, and you think you're going to come inquire of God by going to Ezekiel and asking him questions sitting in front of him? Really? That's an option presented by Gil. Another option is that the elders are asking, or Yahweh is referring to the elders asking in good faith. So Yahweh would be saying to the elders, have you come to inquire of me, wanting to know the truth? I'm not sure which way it goes. I think it's the latter, sarcastic. Really? You coming to inquire of me? Well, what were they inquiring about? Jameson Fawcett Brown says, probably it was to ascertain the cause of the national calamities and the time of their termination, as their false prophets assured them of a speedy restoration. So we can be sure the false prophets are saying, this won't be too bad. We'll get back to Jerusalem pretty soon. But they wanted to have the big prophet, the great prophet Ezekiel, to confirm that. And so they come to ask Ezekiel. God shuts them down. He says, as surely as I live, that's an oath. Because God can swear by no one higher than himself. That's a common oath, as a matter of fact. When God swears, he swears by himself. As surely as I live, and it's sure that I do live, and so this is going to happen, I will not let you inquire of me. So you can forget about it. God is not going to answer people who openly sin against him. Declares the Sovereign Lord, I will not let you inquire of me. Will you judge them? Now he's turning back to Ezekiel, and he says to Ezekiel, will you judge them? Will you judge them, Son of Man? Rhetorical question, or possibly a rhetorical question. Two possible answers. What's the expected answer? Option number one, no, Ezekiel, you will not judge them. As John Gill says, you will not excuse them, patronize them, defend their cause, and plead for them. Surely thou wilt not. I like Gill, 19th century man, talking in 17th century King James English. But no, I don't think that's the proper option, because the very next sentence says, well, then confront them, Ezekiel. Then confront them with the detestable practices of their fathers. So I'm going to assume that that question, will you judge them, expects a yes answer. Yes, Ezekiel, you will judge them. As John Gill says, wilt thou not reprove and correct them, judge and condemn them for their sins and wickedness? This thou oughtest to do. Great King James English there. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, there is a loud call for immediate judgment. The Hebrew interrogative here is a command. In other words, will you judge them? Should be translated, yes, judge them. Confront them with the idolatry, say to them. In verse 5, on the day I chose Israel, I swore that I'm your God. To summarize, on the day I chose Israel, what day is that? Well, here's some options. The public commentator says it's the day that God made the oath with Abraham. In Exodus 6:8, we read, I will bring you to the land that I swore to give to Abraham. The land that I swore to give to Abraham. That, of course, is Genesis 15. Numbers 14:30, I swear that none of you will enter the land I promised to settle you in. Again, Genesis 15 promised to Abraham. The problem with that is that Ezekiel 20, verses 6 and 7, talk about Israel being brought out of Egypt, which is much later, over 400 years later, than the promise made to Abraham. I don't know why the pulpit commentator thought that this day that the oath was taken by God had anything to do with Abraham. I don't know, but I don't think the oath did have anything to do with the Abrahamic covenant. Well, option number two is the day that God swore to reveal himself as Yahweh would be the day that God made the oath with Moses at Mount Sinai. That's my speculation, but my speculation is not good there because, again, verses 6 and 7 talk about coming out of Egypt. Moses at Mount Sinai was after that. Not long after that, but it was somewhat after that. So let's look at the correct option, in my humble opinion, option number 3. This day that God took this oath was when God revealed himself to Moses as Yahweh. This is Colin Delitzsch's opinion, and they cite Exodus 6:2, which says this, "Then God spoke to Moses, telling him, 'I am Yahweh.'" That's when God revealed himself as Yahweh. Going back to Ezekiel 20, we read this, "On the day I chose Israel, I swore with uplifted hand and revealed myself to them in Egypt." That's when he revealed himself, when he told Moses, "I am Yahweh," Exodus 6:2. Now, we notice that on that day that he revealed himself to Israel, that he chose Israel. That means Israel is elect. Israel are the chosen people. We read of this election in Isaiah 14:1, "For the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and will choose Israel again." Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 through 7, "For you are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be his own possession." Jeremiah 33, verse 24, "Have you not noticed what these people have said? They say the Lord has rejected the two families he had chosen." So now we know why the Jews are called the chosen people, or at least the nation of Israel was called the chosen nation, an elect nation. And that happened when he revealed himself to Israel through Moses. And on that day, he swore with an uplifted hand. Now, swearing is done by holding your hand up to take an oath, just like we do today in court. "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God." What was the swearing that God did? What was the oath that he took? That he would bring the Jews out of Egypt, verse 6, and into the promised land. Now, this oath was so important, it's mentioned 3 times here. In verses 5 and 6. In verse 5, the oath is mentioned twice. Let me read that again. "This is what the Sovereign Lord says, 'On the day I chose Israel, I swore with uplifted hand.'" That's the first time. And then later on in the same verse, "with uplifted hand." That means he's taken another oath. He's taken the same oath, actually. It's mentioned another time. The second time, "with uplifted hand, God said, 'I am the Lord your God.'" And then verse 6, "I swore to them that I would bring them out of Egypt." He mentions that oath that he took with his chosen people 3 times. He mentions it in 2 verses. That shows how serious God was about this oath. Now, as I was saying, this oath was done on a day, the day that God chose Israel. That day is not specified in the text. I gave you 3 options as to when it was. When God made the oath with Abraham? No. When God made the oath with Moses at Sinai? No. But when he revealed himself to Moses while Moses was still in Egypt? Yes. It could be that day just means a general time referring to the beginning of Israel's existence, and we don't need to tie it down that tightly. That was my idea, but I don't think so. I think it was referring to the time that God revealed himself to Moses, and God said, "I am Yahweh." And so the promise in verse 6 is that Israel will be taken to a land of milk and honey, the most beautiful of all lands. And verse 7, here's the condition. "You need to get rid of the vile images you have set your eyes on. Do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt." Now we're going to see that they did do that. They did defile themselves with the idols of Egypt. So we move now to Ezekiel 20, verses 8 through 12. "But they rebelled against me and would not listen to me." This is God still speaking. "They did not get rid of the vile images they had set their eyes on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and spend my anger against them in Egypt. But for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nation they lived among and in whose sight I had revealed myself to the Israelites by bringing them out of Egypt. Therefore I led them out of Egypt and brought them into the desert. I gave them my decrees and made known to them my laws, for the man who obeys them will live by them. Also, I gave them my Sabbaths as a sign between us, so they would know that I, the Lord, made them holy." Now, in verse 8, we encounter an interesting historical fact. The Jews did not forsake the idols of Egypt. In other words, they were committing idolatry in Egypt, and they continued to do so on the Exodus. Now, Ellicott says that no specific record of this idolatrous rebellion is recorded anywhere, but we can infer that the Jews were committing idolatry in Egypt, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. So they go on the Exodus. They don't get rid of the idols. And so God says, I'm going to pour out my wrath on the Jews and spend my anger against them in Egypt. He was going to punish them for their idolatry in Egypt, but he didn't do it. Remember the Passover, the blood on the lentils, and everybody dying, and the Israelites not having to suffer all those plagues that the Egyptians were suffering. The Israelites were in the land of Goshen in northeast Egypt, and Egypt was totally miserable, but Israel survived. It wasn't because they weren't worshiping idols that they avoided the plagues, but it was, in verse 9, for the sake of Yahweh's name. God says, I don't want to get my name profaned in the eyes of the nations, because everybody would say, what kind of a God is this? The Jews had a God, and his name was Yahweh, and he didn't do anything to protect them. But instead, Yahweh's name was all over the Middle East when people saw the results of the Exodus. They're saying, ooh, Yahweh is not a God you mess with. So God did not punish the idolatry of the Jews, which they were committing in Egypt. He instead brings the Israelites out of Egypt. Verse 9. And verse 10, he led them out of Egypt, brought them into the desert. That's the Exodus. Verse 11, Yahweh says, I gave them my decrees and made known to them my laws. For the man who obeys them will live by them. Now that's a quotation from the law, Leviticus 18:5. God says, keep my statutes and ordinances. A person will live if he does them. I am Yahweh. Now that living there is not talking about eternal life. Keep the law and you'll get saved. That sounds like abject legalism, does it not? But that's not what is meant here. It means you will temporarily live. You obey God's law, and that means as best you can, essentially, not perfectly. You do that and you'll live temporarily. You won't die. God will bless you. Blessings and curses, Deuteronomy 28. Now, Paul quotes this verse in Romans 10:5. Paul says, for Moses writes about the righteousness that is from the law. The one who does these things will live by them. Of course, Paul doesn't think you can live spiritually by keeping the law. But there, the living is eternal life, not temporal life. Paul's trying to say, you're not going to keep the law. You're not going to live by the law. But at any rate, this Leviticus 18:5 is not only quoted here in verse 11, Ezekiel 20, but also in Ezekiel 20, verses 13 and 21, three times. You need to keep my law, Israel, and you're not doing it. Verse 12, God gave the Jews my Sabbaths as a sign between us. Now that's not only the weekly Sabbaths, but also the seven-year Sabbath. At the end of 7 years, the land was to lie fallow. Also the Jubilee Sabbath, that's at the end of seven sevens, the 50th year after 49 years. The land is supposed to lie fallow, 49, year 49 and year 50. And also all debts were released at the Jubilee year, the symbol of freedom, which of course is all a type of our freedom in Christ. In verse 12, the Sabbaths were given to Israel by God as a sign between God and Israel. And of course, all covenants have a sign. The Sabbath was the sign of the Mosaic covenant. Circumcision was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. The rainbow was the sign of the Noahic covenant, the covenant of Noah. The cup in Jesus' blood was the sign of the new covenant that we honor every time we do communion. In verse 12, the Sabbaths were given so that the Lord would know that Israel was made holy. That means Israel is set apart from the nations, that they keep a Sabbath, a Saturday Sabbath, that let everybody know this nation is different. It's separate. That's what holy means, separate from the world, dedicated to God. The Sabbath was given as a pledge of their entering into the land of rest and of the future rest to be enjoyed by Christ and in heaven to all eternity. It's a great type of the religious rest that we get. Adam Clark says that the religious observance of the Sabbath was the first statute or command of God to men. I don't know what he means by that. I mean, I would think the first statute that God gave to man would be, thou shalt have no other God before me. The Sabbath not only symbolized rest, but it also reminded the Israelites of the creation of the world. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, not that the Sabbath was first instituted at Sinai as if it were an exclusively Jewish ordinance, but it was then more formally enacted when, owing to the apostasy of the world from the original revelation, one people was called out to be the covenant people of God. Now that's an interesting idea, the idea that the Sabbath is for everybody, not just for the Jews. Well, I don't know. I don't worship God on Saturday. I find that highly problematical, the statement by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. We go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 13 through 20. Yahweh continues, "Yet the people of Israel rebelled against me in the desert. They did not follow my decrees, but rejected my laws, although the man who obeys them will live by them. And they utterly desecrated my Sabbaths. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and destroy them in the desert. But for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. Also, with uplifted hand, I swore to them in the desert that I would not bring them into the land I had given them, a land flowing with milk and honey, most beautiful of all lands, because they rejected my laws and did not follow my decrees and desecrated my Sabbaths. For their hearts were devoted to their idols. Yet I looked on them with pity and did not destroy them or put an end to them in the desert. I said to their children in the desert, do not follow the statutes of your fathers or keep their laws or defile yourselves with their idols. I am the Lord your God. Follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Keep my Sabbaths holy, that they may be a sign between us. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." So in verse 13, Yahweh says Israel rebelled against Yahweh in the desert. Jameson Fawcett Brown has an apt comment here. He says, or they say, "They rebelled in the very place where death and terror were on every side and where they depended on my miraculous bounty every moment." In other words, if you're going to rebel against God, the worst place to rebel against God is in the desert, because if you rebel against God, you don't have any help anymore and the desert's going to kill you. So Israel rejected God's laws. Although the man who obeys them will live by them, Yahweh says. That's Leviticus 18:5, which is repeated in verse 21 and verse 11. And then God says, "They utterly desecrated my Sabbath," the Sabbath which was a sign of the Mosaic covenant. It was serious business to do that. There are two classic examples given to us in the law. The first was when some of the people went out looking for manna on the Sabbath day. In Exodus 16, verses 27 through 28, we read this, "Yet on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they did not find any. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and instructions?" In another place, a man was gathering firewood on the Sabbath, Numbers 15, verses 32 through 36. While the Israelites were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses, Aaron, and the entire community. They placed him in custody because it had not been decided what should be done to him. Then the Lord told Moses, "The man is to be put to death. The entire community is to stone him outside the camp." So the entire community brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death, as the Lord had commanded Moses. So, going back to Ezekiel 20, verse 13, Yahweh says that the Israelites had utterly desecrated his Sabbaths. So God says, "I'm going to pour out my wrath on them and destroy them in the desert." But we know he didn't do that. Why? Because in verse 14, "For the sake of Yahweh's name, for the sake of God's name, he's not going to let his name be profaned," because if he allowed the Jews to be wiped out, everybody would say, "What kind of a God is Yahweh to allow something like this?" So God's not going to let them be wiped out in order to preserve the sanctity of his name, but he is going to punish the Jews for their idolatry and Sabbath breaking. He's going to not let them enter into the promised land. Now, of course, we know that some of them did, but anybody that was 20 years old or older upon leaving Egypt, they died in the wilderness. But their kids, people who were under 20 years old, they managed to cross the Jordan River with Joshua, and they did make it in. Now, those who were prohibited from entering in, it says in verse 16, their hearts were devoted to their idols. That shows that they had idols from Egypt. This is the only place we know that the Jews were doing idolatry in Egypt, is here in Ezekiel. So God in verse 17, he looks on the Israelites. He decides, well, I'm not going to destroy them. I'm not going to put an end to them in the desert, but I am going to punish them. In verse 18, Yahweh says to the rebellious Jews' children, and of course those are the ones that are under 20 years old, the ones that are going to make it into the promised land, as Benson points out. As Ellicott says, these children were the generation which grew up in the free air of the wilderness and under the influence of the legislation and institutions given at Sinai. In other words, they weren't idolaters in Egypt like their parents were. So God says to the children, Don't do idolatry like your fathers did. Follow my decrees, verse 19, verse 20. Keep my Sabbath holy, so there'll still be a sign between Yahweh and you. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. We go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 21 through 26. But the children rebelled against me. Well, the fathers rebelled. They fell dead in the wilderness. The children are allowed to go in, but doesn't matter. They go into the promised land, and they still continue with the same old idolatry. They did not follow my decrees. They were not careful to keep my laws, although the man who obeys them will live by them. And they desecrated my Sabbaths, so I said I would pour out my wrath on them and spend my anger against them in the desert. But I withheld my hand, and for the sake of my name I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. Also with uplifted hand I swore to them in the desert that I would disperse them among the nations and scatter them through the countries, because they had not obeyed my laws, but had rejected my decrees and desecrated my Sabbaths, and their eyes lusted after their fathers' idols. I also gave them over to statutes that were not good and laws they could not live by. I let them become defiled through their gifts, the sacrifice of every firstborn, that I might fill them with horror so they would know that I am the Lord. So in verse 21, the children, those who had not fallen in the wilderness, those who were over 20 fell in the wilderness, but the children under 20, they go into the promised land, but they were just like their fathers. They did not follow God's decrees. They desecrated God's Sabbaths, and God says, I'm going to pour out my wrath on them. Now he says in verse 21, he's going to do that before they got into the promised land. That's in the desert. Those who are under 20 getting ready to go in. But God says, no, I'm going to let the children go on into the promised land. Why? For the sake of Yahweh's name. It would look bad if all of Israel was wiped out when God had made a covenant with Israel that they would inherit the land and their offspring would be blessings to the nation. It would look very, very bad, like Yahweh was a weak God who could not keep his own covenant. In verse 23, God says, with uplifted hand, I swore to them in the desert that I would disperse them among the nations. Now, this is a fulfillment of the curses in the law, Deuteronomy 28, verses 36 through 37. The Lord will bring you and your king that you have appointed to a nation neither you nor your fathers have known. And there you will worship other gods of wood and stone. You will become an object of horror, scorn, and ridicule among all the peoples where the Lord will drive you. And so the swearing in the desert that God did was by giving this law, which tells them, if you keep sinning against me, I'm going to disperse you among the nations. And of course, that happened to Ezekiel's audience. They were exiles in Babylon because they kept desecrating the Sabbaths and kept committing idolatry. They were scattered. God says in verse 23, I'm going to scatter these rebellious Jews through the countries. Well, we see that in Leviticus 26:33, but I will scatter you among the nations. I will draw a sword to chase after you. So your land will become desolate and your cities will become ruins. This is mentioned again in Psalms 106, verses 26 through 27. So he, that's God, raised his hand against them with an oath that he would make them fall in the desert and would disperse their descendants among the nations, scattering them throughout the land. That sounds like it's a direct quote of Ezekiel. I don't know if it is, or whether Ezekiel is quoting Psalms. I'm not sure, but the idea is the same. And of course, this scattering and dispersing of the Jews was fulfilled after the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and the Roman destruction of Jerusalem and Israel in AD 70. Now in verse 25, God says that he gave the Israelites over to statutes that were not good. What are these not good statutes? Option number one, the Mosaic Law. Well, that doesn't seem right because the law, of course, is good. It's holy. Ellicott, in fact, denies that option. But here's how people who want to say this interpret it. They say that the Mosaic Law is not good in the sense that the punishment for breaking that Mosaic Code was so severe, death, usually. Ellicott points out that many of the church fathers held this view, so that verse 25 would read this way, I, Yahweh, also gave the Jews over to statutes that were not good because the Mosaic Law condemned them for their sins. I don't think so. I think it's talking about the laws of pagan nations round about who either came into Israel and the customs and laws of other nations started influencing the Jews and how they carried out their lives, or it could be the laws of the nations into whom the Jews were sent into exile. Ellicott says this, "These evil statutes and judgments were those adopted from the heathen whom they had suffered to dwell among them and from the surrounding nations." And I would add, and maybe also the nations they were exiled to, that might be the source of these not good laws. So God says, I'm going to give the Jews over to statutes that were not good. And then he says in verse 26, Ezekiel 20, that God would let the Jews become defiled through their gifts. Well, how is that? Well, I guess you could say gifts given to idols would defile the people, but there's a specific type of gift that's mentioned in verse 26, the sacrifice of every firstborn. Now, I really don't like the NIV translation here. So let me give you the Holman Christian Study Bible translation of verse 26. When they made every firstborn pass through the fire, I defiled them through their gifts. In other words, this was child sacrifice to Molech, as Benson points out. Jameson Fawcett Brown disagrees with that. He says that the sacrifice of a firstborn is actually just the presenting of the firstborn to God, as was required, of course, in the law. The firstborn belonged to God. You had to redeem him. You had to pay the priest some money so he can get your firstborn baby back. That gets rid of the idea of sacrificing a child to Molech, the child-sacrificing idol. Well, but why is that a bad thing? Well, because Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the sacrificing or the presenting of the firstborn to God according to the law was polluted by pagan practices, and so it wasn't pure anymore. I don't know. That's a lot of speculation. It just makes more sense to say that it's passing the baby through the fire. And that's what God's upset about. That's why I like the Holman Christian Study Bible translation better. Let me back up to verse 21. I skipped something here. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them in the desert. Well, here's an example of where that happened. 24,000 Jews died on account of the idolatry at the incident of Baal Peor in Numbers 25:9, which reads, "But those who died in the plague, number 24,000, that's when Balak of Moab allied with Amalek, got Balaam of Syria to come down and prophesy against the Jews, and while that was happening, the Jews shacked up with women of Amalek, I believe it was. That's when Phinehas went into one of the tents and speared a Jew in the midst of having sex with an adulterous woman. Great story, I love it. The zeal of Phinehas. But anyway, 24,000 people died after that incident. Idolatry does not pay. Not in the law, not in the history of Israel. And all of this was done, as verse 26 concludes with, that I might fill them with horror so they would know that I am the Lord. And folks, that's what people today need to know. They need to be filled with horror when they contemplate all their filthy, stupid, immoral acts that they're doing here in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, as they're chopping off the penises of little boys and giving little girls double mastectomies, all in the name of quote-unquote gender-affirming care. And while they rip the limbs of little babies from their torsos with chemicals or with forceps, I don't know how they do it now, but they're murdering babies. And there needs to be some more people around here that are filled with horror when they contemplate such horrible practices. We go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 27 through 31, and we will finish this audio. I don't have too much to say about these five verses, just a few things, so I'm just going to read it quickly. "Therefore, son of man, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says, in this also your fathers blasphemed me by forsaking me, when I brought them into the land I had sworn to give them, and they saw any high hill or any leafy tree, there they offered their sacrifices, made offerings that provoked me to anger, presented their fragrant incense, and poured out their drink offerings. Then I said to them, what is this high place you go to? It is called Bema to this day." Let me stop right there. Bema means high place, as the NIV note says, and as Barnes says. I'll talk about why the word is used there in just a minute. It's not very clear. Verse 30, "Therefore say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says, will you defile yourselves the way your fathers did and lust after their vile images when you offer your gifts, the sacrifice of your sons in the fire? You continue to defile yourselves with all your idols to this day. Am I to let you inquire of me, O house of Israel? As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will not let you inquire of me. The sacrifice of the Jews' sons in the fire mentioned in verse 31 actually happened during the times of Ahab and Manasseh, which was less than a century earlier than this. It makes me wonder whether the Jews might still be doing it. It's not recorded anywhere, but you wonder. Now, verse 29 has an interesting phrase in it. The high place that the Israelites were going to is called Bema to this day. Well, Bema is the Hebrew word for high place, so the high place is called high place to this day. What does that mean? Well, most of my commentators were not very helpful on this, so this is the way I piece it together. In other words, when an Israelite was asked where he was going, he would say, I'm going to a high place. Now, everybody knew where that was. He was going to sacrifice to an idol because that's where idols were. They were on hills. A high place was the commonly understood word to refer to a place of idolatry. So basically, places of idolatry were called high places even to the time of Ezekiel to this day. And so, in other words, the Israelites went to high places so much that the name high place stuck in the language as a place of idolatry. And the reason it stuck in the language as a place of idolatry is because the Israelites did it so much. Now, finally, in verse 31, I need to note, God says, am I to let you inquire of me, O house of Israel? That's a repeat of what he said in verse 3, and the answer is no. No, as God says at the end of verse 31, I will not let you inquire of me. Remember, this whole passage chapter started when the elders of Israel went into Ezekiel's home, sat in front of him, and tried to inquire of Ezekiel what's going to happen. And so God says, you're going to inquire of me? I will not let you inquire of me. Why? Because you are miserable, filthy, rotten, vermin, idolaters. Well, on that pleasant note, we have finished our audio covering the first 31 verses of chapter 20 of Ezekiel. That prepares us to go to the second part of Ezekiel 20, which I will entitle, The Lord Will Restore Israel. So a lot of bad news in this audio, some good news in the next audio, because God always tempers his judgments with mercy. And so I hope to see you in our next audio as we continue on in our study of Ezekiel. I hope you enjoyed this audio.